Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. One of the biggest police operations London has ever seen is taking place as President Obama and other world leaders hold high-level meetings on the eve of the G20 summit. Police cleared protesters away from the Bank of England, but others broke into a branch of the Royal Bank of Scotland. Joining us from his cell phone is Alok Jha, science and environment reporter for The Guardian newspaper. He's been tweeting from the protest outside the Royal Bank of Scotland building. Alok, what are you seeing and, you know, what have you seen?
Well, I'm standing in the square mile in the city of London, which is the financial heart of the city and in some ways the sort of representative of some of the economic crisis that's been going on. About 2,000 or 3,000 people, we've been penned in by the police. All the roads leading out from here have been blocked off. It's fairly peaceful where I am. There were some skirmishes earlier in the day. About 11 people were arrested. And that was all outside the Royal Bank of Scotland, one of their branches. That particular area has been the scene of most anger from the protesters.
Well, remind us why the anger is directed at the Royal Bank of Scotland in particular.
Well, the Royal Bank of Scotland is the highest profile casualty in the UK of the economic crisis. So the government has bailed out the bank with tens of billions of pounds because of its mistakes. Another issue is that the outgoing chief executive of the bank, Sir Fred Goodwin, left the bank last year when he was forced out, actually. The deal that he got was that he would be paid a pension of something like £700,000 a year, something like that. And this has caused a huge amount of anger here in England. A lot of people demanding the money back, even the government. Gordon Brown, our Prime Minister, has been demanding, you know, do the right thing, do the morally right thing, give us the money back. He's refused to do it. So the Royal Bank of Scotland is kind of the hated bank. It's a symbol of this economic problems that we're facing in the UK. And what's happened in this particular branch is that a hardcore group of anarchists, about 20 of them, actually smashed into the bank earlier and just came out with computers and files and, you know, we've been pushed back from there now.
Well, and how are financial district workers reacting to these thousands of protesters? We understand some bankers didn't wear their pinstripes today. They wore casual wear. But that also some financial workers there are leaning out their office windows and taunting demonstrators.
Well, that's what we have heard. Around this particular central area, it looks like all the banks are closed. Certainly in the central area where I am now, you would normally on a Wednesday morning have, it would be busy with traffic and there'd be hundreds of people in their pinstripe suits walking around. There are no people like that here today. Anyone in a pinstripe suit is probably a protester, and they're usually wearing devil masks or death masks to drive home their point. There were people leaning out of office blocks earlier in the day, I think waving £10 notes at the some of the protesters, but as those say, there's none of those anymore.
Well, and we know many of these are organized protests, different groups that have come, but are you also meeting just the average British man on the street who's lost his job, who's now standing on the street protesting?
There are a lot of those. There are the groups, as you mentioned, so there's people against the war, people against climate change, people against the economic bailout. But also there are lots of observers, people who are just kind of curious about the protests. I met one woman who's a Russian, she's retired, and she's here protesting about her pension being downgraded. And there's people young and old here, some people who look like they should really be in school, and then lots of others who are much older protesting about the fact that the money given to the banks is not filtering down to them. There's people who've lost their jobs in businesses, architects, marketing people. Lots of people are here because of a lot of anger. I mean, it's contained, actually. There's only very few people actually shouting at police or anything like that. But there are a lot of people just peacefully standing who are just upset with the situation that we're in. They're bakers or the people who work down a local shop. We can't afford to get loans because of the fact that our economy is in such dire straits.
Yeah. What's jumped out at you before we let you go, Alok? What's the scene that's jumped out at you from today?
Well, for me, the wonderful thing that sort of made me smile a little bit was that the main crowd itself has been very, it's been carnival-like, it's been quite peaceful. But one chap, what he did was to free climb the Bank of England. You'd never see this happening any other time. He went up there, up the pillars with no rope, to attach some banners. And when he did that, there was a little crowd of something like 300 or 400 people watching his every move, sort of there, gnawing at their fingers in case he fell off. But he got up there, he put the banner up, and his arms went up, and there was the biggest cheer. And I just thought there's some more optimism despite the sort of terrible stuff that these people are protesting against.
You write on your tweet, that was when the crowd was gobsmacked by a protesting Spider-Man.
That's right.
That's Alok Jha, science and environment reporter for The Guardian newspaper, who's been tweeting from the protest outside the Royal Bank of Scotland building today. Alok, thanks so much.
Thank you.
General David Petraeus confirmed in Congress today what everyone already knows. The Taliban is growing in influence in Afghanistan. Well, our next guest says the reason is, in part, because Pakistan's military intelligence agency, the ISI, is directly supporting the Taliban. Well, turns out just about everyone knows that, too. So what's being done about it? Mark Mazzetti is national security correspondent for The New York Times. He joins us from the studios of the Christian Science Monitor in Washington, D.C. for a deeper look today at the complicated Pakistan-U.S. relationship. Mark, thank you.
Good to be here.
And your recent headline, it was this week, I think, in the Times, said, Afghan strikes by Taliban getting Pakistan help. And it made some of us want to say, still? But you write it's sort of more help. What kind of help?
In our story last week, we sort of documented the evidence that that Pakistan's or spy service or operatives from Pakistan's spy service were giving ammunition, fuel, logistical support, money, training help to Taliban commanders and Taliban operatives both in southern Pakistan and in Afghanistan.
In fact,
as you said, this is a something that has gone on for some time. The ISI, which is Pakistan's military spy agency, has supported the Taliban for years. Yet over the past year, U.S. officials have been cajoling Pakistan's government to get these ties to end and to sever this relationship. And as we say in the story, it really has not had much effect, that this support continues.
Well, not only continues, but seems to be ramped up. And this despite the fact that Pakistan, you report, said that they stopped playing this double game.
That's right. At the very least, Pakistan's civilian government has said that they have stopped the double game. And there, as we say in the story, there is no evidence that this help to the Taliban is blessed by the top civilian leaders in Islamabad or even the top military leaders in Islamabad. But there may be some kind of benign neglect situation. There may be a don't ask, don't tell, where there is lower level contact inside the ISI with the Taliban, and there are not too many questions asked at in the top ranks of the military. It's a situation that is so complicated and has so many different layers that Obama administration officials who are sort of taking on this problem admit that they don't have a firm grasp of the complexity of the situation.
Right, and we want to learn more about those complexities. For instance, there are different Taliban. But staying with the transparency, you know, it's so transparent that you write of a scenario in which the British asked the Pakistani officials, in effect, hey, next time you meet with the Taliban, could you get them to turn down violence in Afghanistan before the elections? It's, you know, it's that transparent.
Right. It was just, it seemed to be a sort of concession to the fact that they're not going to really get these contacts to stop. So they might as well use some leverage to their advantage. In other words, have the ISI convince the Taliban to ratchet back the violence in the next few months before the elections in Afghanistan.
Even though no one's saying that they're talking to the Taliban. Well, most of these contacts, you report, are carried out by the so-called S-Wing of the Pakistani Intelligence Agency. What do we know about the S-Wing?
Very little, actually. And actually, when you talk to people about the S-Wing in Washington or in Islamabad, everyone kind of clams up, and it's not something people talk about much at all. It's a it's our understanding that the S-Wing is a division inside the ISI that deals with external operations. In other words, operations outside of Pakistan. So they're the ones who deal with groups that operate in Afghanistan and elsewhere. They're the sort of foreign intelligence operative wing, but it's not something that the ISI acknowledge exists, and it's difficult to get too much information about how this group operates.
Well, what's it like for American intelligence, then, to work with their so-called allies in Pakistan, not knowing, you know, which of the Pakistan intelligence might also be double agents? Talking to the Taliban.
I think it sort of goes with the territory with CIA operatives who operate in Pakistan. I think that they go in feeling that there's no chance that they're going to get 100% support, but that if they can get 60 to 70% support, in terms of support meaning, you know, support for the American agenda, then they're well off. The feeling is that the ISI has been very helpful in some cases in helping wrap up Al-Qaeda operatives in Pakistan, especially in Pakistani cities. And so if they can get support on that front, you know, then they should keep up this relationship with the ISI, even though there may be ISI operatives who are acting against American interests. I mean, it's not totally atypical in the spy game to know that the people you're trying to trust are also with another hand operating with your enemy. It's a complex situation already, but then when it comes to Pakistan, it's just an even greater level of complexity.
Well, and you write that some in American intelligence are actually in awe of the ISI. Why?
Well, I think that there's a certain Machiavellian quality to the ISI that people I've talked to in the CIA and former CIA officials respect, and they are incredibly effective. And very powerful. You know, we shouldn't forget that the most powerful institution in Pakistan is the military, and the ISI is the military spy service. They're really just an arm of Pakistan's military. So they have decades of being able to operate in this area and operate quite effectively. I mean, we should also remember the history. The ISI was instrumental in helping the U.S. arm the Afghan Mujahideen against the Soviets in the 70s and 80s. And so there is a long history of a very close relationship between the U.S. and the ISI.
Well, there's another piece of history, too, which is that Pakistan helped form the Taliban in the 90s to sort of stabilize their neighbor Afghanistan after the civil war between warlords.
That's right. And you know, if you look at the history in Afghanistan after the Soviets left and there was this period of just chaos and civil war in Afghanistan, the Taliban were seen as a sort of stabilizing force that could help tamp down the violence and bring some security to Pakistan's neighbor. So Pakistan saw this as a benefit to not have the chaos on its border and using the Taliban and supporting the Taliban to keep the chaos from spreading over the border into Pakistan.
Right. That's Mark Mazzetti, New York Times national security correspondent. We've got a lot more questions for you, Mark. We'll pose them after a minute break. Also, just a reminder, later today, a series of recently uncovered letters written by an American priest in the 50s warning the Pope and the Catholic Church about sexually abusive priests. We'll have that story as well. Back in 1 minute with Mark Mazzetti, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. General David Petraeus spoke to the Armed Services Committee this morning, echoing the latest Pentagon report on Afghanistan and Pakistan, which says there are no quick fixes to achieve U.S. goals in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and the danger of failure is real. The implications are grave. Well, we've been speaking with Mark Mazzetti of the New York Times about how hard stabilizing that region might be, given the complicated relationship between Pakistan, Afghanistan, and the U.S., and the fact that Pakistan ISI intelligence officials have been speaking with, working with the Taliban in Afghanistan. And Mark, question for you. The Obama administration has also said that they're considering talking to the Taliban as a way out of the mess in Afghanistan. So how can, you know, the White House be critical of Pakistan for doing the same thing?
I think the feeling is that Pakistan's ISI is giving lethal and high-level support to the Taliban, and that means giving it to the commanders who are based mostly around the city of Quetta, Pakistan, and that this is going directly towards killing American and coalition troops.
And you're talking about weapons and things. You're not talking about chats.
That's correct. It could be anything from ammunition to fuel, training, logistical support, that type of thing. And the American view is that, okay, the Taliban is a monolith. They're not all quote unquote bad. They're a lot of them are foot soldiers who would gladly put down their weapons for stability and basic services in Afghanistan. And a lot of them are just fighting in Afghanistan because they don't believe that the Karzai government is here to stay, and that it's a better bet betting on the Taliban right now.
Well, some I'm sorry to interrupt, but some Pakistan officials have also said that they're speaking with this moderate Taliban to prepare for when the U.S. pulls out of Afghanistan, so there won't be a power vacuum that India can walk into.
That's right. I mean, there's a lot of hedging of bets going on that the ISI, and again, it may not be the senior levels of the ISI, but there's certain operatives in the ISI who would keep contacts because their feeling is they're going to be here a lot longer than the United States is. So the contacts that they forge are lasting, and even if they're not, even if they stop directly supporting the Taliban, they would not cease to have contact with them because they're going to need these contacts in the future. And so it's the feeling that that the long-term goals for Pakistan are not only maintaining influence in Afghanistan, but, and perhaps most importantly for Pakistan, it's countering India and countering the influence that India has in the region, and that's expanding influence. They see the Karzai government in Afghanistan as getting increasingly close to India, and India is building roads in Afghanistan and throwing a lot of economic muscle around Afghanistan. So they are looking at it in terms of the sort of strategic balance of how do they counter that influence.
Yeah. Karzai went to college in Delhi. Meanwhile, I just want to have mentioned, too, that Pakistan, if it's not complicated enough, Pakistan is also fighting the Taliban, including one group that issued a statement yesterday claiming responsibility for that brutal attack on a police academy this week. He also vowed a spectacular attack on the U.S. So the U.S. watches, Pakistan officials do that as well.
And there's no question that Pakistan, you're right, is fighting its own war against militancy. And if you look at the attacks in Pakistan over the last year plus, the violence is going up, from the assassination of Benazir Bhutto to the bombing of a Marriott hotel in Islamabad. And I think there's a concern in Pakistan and also in Washington that there was a sort of Frankenstein's monster situation where some of the groups that the ISI and the military helped nurture years ago have turned against the creator and are now launching attacks inside of Pakistan.
Yeah. Just in the last minute we have, Mark Mazzetti, what about the role of the U.S. Special Envoy Richard Holbrooke, perhaps even versus the role of Secretary of State Hillary Clinton? Are these two people up to this snare in Pakistan?
Well, Richard Holbrooke certainly is a gifted diplomat with a lot of experience in the diplomatic world, and he's dealt with a lot of thorny situations in the past, and so I think that they felt like he was one of the best people to get to be given this very, very difficult problem. And the benefit the Obama administration said of having him as a White House envoy was that he didn't need to be confirmed by the Senate; he could immediately start the process that where there's not a lot of time to waste. And so, as opposed to having him directly report to Hillary Clinton as a White House, as a State Department staffer, in this case, he answers to President Obama and has kind of hit the ground running.
That's Mark Mazzetti, New York Times national security correspondent, speaking to us from the studios of the Christian Science Monitor in Washington, D.C., taking a deeper look at the relationship between Pakistan, U.S., Afghanistan, and it's a tangled one. Mark, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
Well, just a quick note. Today we received an email telling us we were being listened to in a small town in Turkey. School children were learning English. We were invited over to receive the keys to the city. Robin Young, it said, was hilarious, amusing, also big heart she has. That does sound like Borat, doesn't it? April Fools. It was a prank from our colleague Steph. Nice try, Steph. Good, but not the best. That would be the one the BBC pulled off in 1957. The reporter said thanks to a mild winter and the elimination of the dreaded spaghetti weevil, farmers in Switzerland were enjoying a wonderful spaghetti harvest. Huge numbers of viewers called the BBC to see how they could grow a spaghetti tree. It's all from the Museum of Hoaxes website. To get to it, go to oursherenow.org. And by the way, we are listened to in Turkey, just not in that small town. We'll be back after the news. You're listening to Here and Now. You could say the endangered Sumatran tigers are striking back. They're on a killing rampage in Indonesia, where six people have been attacked and killed by the tigers since February. Most of the victims, including three men killed last weekend, have been illegal loggers whose operations encroach on rapidly shrinking tiger habitat. Half of Sumatra's forests have been cleared for wood in the last 20 years, and conservationists say there's simply not enough habitat left to support the 400 Sumatran tigers that are still alive. The BBC's Lucy Williamson traveled with the men who work as tiger catchers.
Even in daylight, this journey is thick with fear. Creeping our way into the forest along a rough track laid by illegal loggers months before, the vegetation was close enough to touch, and tigers, with a taste for human flesh, still out there somewhere. For Indonesia's tiger catchers, this is their daily commute. But their guns and jokey bravado couldn't quite hide their fear. People are being killed and eaten here at the rate of one a week, and the job of these men is to track and catch the tigers who are doing it. Last month they got lucky. Salma, they called her, a tigress, 2 meters long, angry and scared. She's now in a local zoo, but the attacks haven't stopped, and so we're going with the team to another attack site to investigate. This is the site where one of the victims was killed. It's an illegal logging site, and it's right in the middle of the jungle. It's a really remote spot. Everything is pretty much as he left it. There are all the tree trunks laid out, ready to be shipped back out of the forest. And over there, just ahead of me, now, just a bundle of twigs, really, is the hut where the man himself was attacked and killed. There were no footprints left to inspect at the site, and no sign of a tiger. But in terms of why these attacks are happening, Chief Tiger Catcher Nurazman says this place is right on target.
The main problem is illegal logging. It's destroying the tiger's habitat. This place, for example, it's an illegal logging area. They don't have a permit for what they're doing here. It's illegal.
It might be illegal, but for people here, the punishment seems disproportionate. In one village, the women crowd around to tell me how they lock their doors by 6 p.m. and lie awake at night listening for the sound of tigers. 2 men were killed here this month, just a few meters from their house. They were cutting wood at the time. But one of their relatives, Choco, says they're not to blame for these attacks.
We are victims, not thieves. We go into the forest to put food on the table. They can't blame us for this conflict with the tigers.
Hundreds of kilometers away in the provincial capital, the district chief, Bahanadin Hanir, agrees. The real cause of this conflict, he says, is a new industrial logging company with all the right legal permits, which has just opened nearby. The question everyone's asking is, why was a logging company allowed to operate in the tiger's dwindling territory?
We only found out there were tigers in the area after the investors started chopping down the trees. Now we have more regulations to protect the tigers' habitat. But the problem is the tigers are already disturbed and angry. They're just like humans, really.
Sumatra's forests are now so decimated they can't support even the few hundred wild tigers that are left. The government is aware of the problem, but back at the attack site, Narasman is feeling dejected. There's no long-term plan, he tells me. We're just trying to keep the tigers and the humans apart. It's a dangerous job, and not one he enjoys. But Narasman and his team are battling bigger forces than tigers here. They're up against the world's hunger for Indonesia's forests and the timber and paper and palm oil they provide.
That's the BBC's Lucy Williamson reporting from Sumatra. We'll be back in half a minute, here and now. A series of newly uncovered letters dating back to the 1950s appears to confirm that the Catholic Church was indeed aware of the magnitude of the priest sex abuse scandal decades before it became public. The National Catholic Reporter obtained the letters from a California law firm. They show Father Gerald Fitzgerald writing to the church's hierarchy, including the Pope, for 20 years, begging them to stop reassigning priests accused of sexually abusing children, saying the priests could not be cured. In one 1957 letter to an archbishop, Father Fitzgerald even suggested putting abusive priests on an island. He writes, "It is for this class of rattlesnake I have always wished the island retreat, but even an island is too good for these vipers of whom the gentle master said it were better they had not been born." Well, despite that last sentiment, Father Fitzgerald did go so far as to put a down payment on an island in the Caribbean. Tom Roberts is editor-at-large for the National Catholic Reporter. He joins us from the studios of KCUR in Kansas City, Missouri. And Tom, you and the paper have been writing about this scandal since the 80s. Your thoughts when these letters were revealed?
I was amazed at the consistency of his language, the clarity with which he seemed to understand the problem, and the force with which he communicated his understanding to both bishops, Vatican officials, and even Pope Paul VI at that time.
And yet nothing was done. Well, tell us, who was Father Gerald Fitzgerald, and why was he writing about these priests?
Father Fitzgerald was originally a priest of the Boston Archdiocese, and he became just concerned about priests that he had seen, particularly alcoholic priests, who were just abandoned. And he ultimately formed an order called the Servants of the Paraclete. He formed that order in 1947, and his intent originally was to take care of primarily alcoholic priests, give them a haven, a place to recuperate, a place to get themselves together again and then get back into ministry. But before long, he began to get a number of priests sent to him by bishops who had sexual problems, and particularly problems of abusing children sexually.
Can you read us some excerpts from letters where it's clear that Father Fitzgerald felt that these abusive priests couldn't be rehabilitated, should never be reassigned to new parishes, although they were, and that he preferred laicizing them or defrocking them or sending them to monasteries?
Well, in a letter as early as 1952, he wrote a letter to the then-bishop of Reno, Nevada, and he said, "I myself would be inclined to favor laicization for any priest upon objective evidence for tampering with the virtue of the young." His argument, he said, was, "From this point onward, the charity to the mystical body," in other words, the entire church, "should take precedence over charity to the individual, and when a man has so far fallen away from the purpose of the priesthood, the very best that should be offered him is his mass in the seclusion of a monastery."
He goes on to say, "Leaving them to wander from diocese to diocese is contributing to scandal, or at least to the approximate danger of scandal." But what did people say back to him? Do we know that?
There wasn't a lot of correspondence back to him. There were a few cases that I saw where bishops who had asked him about particular priests and cases received letters from him saying these are essentially, and I'm paraphrasing loosely here, dangerous characters. They should not be placed back into ministry. He had experience with priests who had been repeat offenders, And he told bishops that their remorse and their contrition couldn't be trusted, that it was probably shallow.
Well, one of these was Father John T. Sullivan, continually reassigned, now we know, continually offending. What was he accused of doing?
He was abusive of young girls, as young as seven, and the abuse continued throughout his career. He died when he was 69, and I think he was finally released from the priesthood for charges of molesting a 12-year-old or a 13-year-old when he was 66.
Right, and this was in Laconia, New Hampshire, but before that it was revealed that he'd provided an abortion for another young girl. He'd impregnated another girl who had a child, and the church supported it.
Right.
Yeah. And yet, there had been warnings about him. Well, Father Fitzgerald even took his concerns to the Pope. He met the Pope in 1963, and in a follow-up letter he wrote, "Where there is an indication of incorrigibility because of the tremendous scandal given, I would most earnestly recommend total laicization." In other words, remove them from the priesthood. All the way to the Pope. Is this the first we know that the Pope was informed of the sex abuse scandal?
This was the first I've ever heard, and any people I've talked to have ever heard, that someone this early in the scandal, who understood it so well, actually had a meeting with the Pope.
Well, Father Fitzgerald's letters are damning, but particularly damning when they're put up against comments from people in the church today. I'm thinking of Cardinal Roger Mahoney of the Los Angeles Archdiocese, who just in February, there was a federal investigation into his handling of the crisis there, said, "We have repeatedly said that our understanding of this problem and the way it's dealt with evolved, and that in those years ago, decades ago, people didn't realize how serious this was." People did realize how serious this was. So, first of all, how are these letters being used in court cases?
They're being used in the case of one priest from Dallas named Rudolph Koss to show that indeed the church understood how dangerous priests were when they were repeat sex offenders, and especially involving children. And I think you've hit one of the real points of the importance of these letters, because Cardinal Mahoney was simply repeating a line that has been the most consistent explanation by the bishops since this scandal broke, about why they did what they did. And it always is, we did not understand the danger of these priests, and we were acting on the best information we had. Well, it's very apparent that for at least 15 years before this scandal ever broke nationally, there was a priest who understood this fairly well.
And told a lot of people. Well, here in Massachusetts, the state removed the statute of limitations in cases of child sexual abuse. Other states are considering similar measures, so there's a chance these letters might show up in future cases. But a couple questions for you. As commendable as he is, Father Fitzgerald never goes to the police. You know, that was an option for him.
It was an option. But in one of his letters, he acknowledges the deference with which priests are treated and says, "I'm surprised at the number of men who would be in jail if they weren't priests, who are still charged with the care of souls."
So he seems to be saying he wasn't even sure he'd, you know, by going through the police, that these men would be treated.
Precisely. Inside the church and outside in that era, you know, there were far different cultures. Priests were held in an esteem that we know probably was dangerous.
And finally, we mentioned Father Fitzgerald's idea. He wanted to put abusive priests on an island. He even put a down payment on an island. Others have advocated this, thinking that pedophiles cannot be rehabilitated, that sadly they need to be in a community of their own. Interesting, he had this idea in 1950. Whatever came of it?
He never got his island. Actually, he did find an island that he thought was isolated enough and vacant enough to serve his purposes. He put a $5,000 down payment on it. The cost of it was, I think, $50,000 at the time. But a new bishop in his diocese that oversaw the Paracletes decided he didn't want anything to do with an island, and Father Fitzgerald had to sell it ultimately. And he was ultimately eased out of control of the order. I think that these documents altogether show, first of all, a very clear analysis of the malady and the danger to the church. I also think that they show that people looking into this story, this awful chapter in church history, should really be following the documents, because wherever they appear, wherever they surface, grand jury reports in Philadelphia and Long Island, the documents that came out in Boston, wherever documents surface, the situation is always far more severe and the problems far deeper than the church acknowledges if the documents stay secret.
That's Tom Roberts, editor-at-large for the National Catholic Reporter. He's read and written about the newly released letters from a priest begging the hierarchy in the Catholic Church not to put abusive priests back in the pulpit. Tom, thanks so much for speaking to us about it.
Pleasure to be with you.
Welcome back to Here and Now. Did you know frogs were the first land animals with vocal cords, and they've been singing with them for over 360 million years?
Frogs are pretty much the only amphibians without tails, yeah, and they've been around since the dinosaurs.
One of the many visitors we met recently at the new Traveling Frog exhibit at Boston's Museum of Science. We saw pond frogs and toads, the African clawed frog that stands up in water, tree frogs like the Chinese gliding frog that has webbed feet that spread like a parachute.
Frogs not only jump, they walk, they climb, they even sometimes glide. And different types of frogs, some go underground, like frogs that live in the desert.
Did you know that an Australian desert frog stores water in its bladder? Aboriginal people sometimes squeeze it and take a drink. Ew. And the bumpy spines of the Vietnamese mossy frog help them blend right in with the lichen they live in.
I can see it.
You can?
Yeah.
Can you show me? I can't find the frog. Where's the frog?
There.
Where is it?
There.
But at least the mossy frogs are protected by the Vietnamese government. 32% of the world's amphibians, including frogs, are endangered, more than birds or mammals. It turns out frogs are the canaries in our global coal mine. And we asked curator Lou Stevens why that is.
Frogs are very sensitive to anything in their environment. They use their skin for respiration, actually. Skin's very thin. It's very sensitive to any sort of chemicals. So pesticides, fertilizers, that sort of thing can impact them. Introduced species, moving animals around the planet, taking some species of trout and moving them to high mountain lakes in the West. Well, yeah, provides for fishing, but these fish just love to eat frogs, and there's a couple of instances of native frogs getting into trouble because of what we put into the environment. The one that's most critical now is a fungus called a chytrid fungus, wreaking havoc in parts of Central America, Australia, and parts of Asia. And when it gets into environment with frogs that have never met up with this thing, you can see 90% of the frogs disappearing within 1 year.
Why? What does it do to them?
The chytrid fungus impacts the keratin layers of frogs in their skin. And if you, again, you're an animal that uses your skin for respiration, you start to thicken that up, you're going to have issues with survival.
And besides the fact that we love frogs and we love how pretty they are, you know, the greens, and there's something about them, they're just, they hop. Besides all that, why do we care that frogs are being wiped out in places?
They're an important part of the ecosystem. They eat lots of insects or other things. They're not all strictly insect eaters. So there's a role for them to play in that environment. A lot of frogs and toads have chemicals that are toxic. And these chemicals, it's one of the odd things about a toxin. At a certain level, it's going to kill you. At another level, it potentially might save your life. So there's a lot of medical research on these chemicals that we find in amphibians and their potential benefit to us.
Take me to another frog that's really cool.
Really cool. Oh, the waxy monkey frogs.
So we made our way to the South American monkey frogs, which climb through trees with grasping feet and protect their skin from the dry air with a waxy secretion. By the way, did you know frog secretions are being studied as treatments for heart ailments and Alzheimer's in humans? But as Lou points out, some frogs, such as the waxy monkey frog, no neck, bulging eyes, are just cute.
It does look sort of wise. Occasionally it sort of, you get the impression from the way its eyes are that it doesn't quite believe what's going on in the universe. It has sort of a look I may have sometimes in the morning. There's an absolute fascination with frogs. When I bring frogs out to do live presentations here at the museum, I'll get done with the presentation and I may spend over an hour at our stage just sitting with the children and having them explain to me their frog stories. And they're an animal that lots and lots of folks can relate to.
Is there a frog we can hold now?
Yes, there is a frog we can hold now.
Oh my gosh. That is the biggest. We are now looking at a little cat carrier, but inside, the size of a small cat, is a frog. What is that?
It's an African bullfrog. It's a couch potato when it comes to frogs. This is a frog that sits and waits for dinner. In Africa, it hangs out in the water holes, just blends in. It's got kind of a greenish, brownish tan to it, so it just becomes part of the muck and algae, and it waits for dinner. So if a mammal the size of a mouse comes down to get a little drink and it's close enough to the frog, it becomes dinner. A bird sparrow size would be dinner. The frog next door would be dinner. It's also a frog that eats other frogs.
Let's see. Oh, is it, will he jump? You've just opened the cage.
Oh, it's not a jumper. It's not a jumper. If you look at the hind legs on this one, very, very short hind legs.
Wow. What do you feel like?
Somebody want to be the scientist and find out?
I'll do it.
You'll do it?
Let's
okay.
Think I do it. Yep.
This is just water. I'm just going to spray your fingers.
Don't poke them right.
Yeah, touch the frog right here along the side. What does he feel like?
He feels gooey.
Yeah. We have a report. He feels gooey. Snide. Does this frog make any noise?
It's a call similar to the bullfrog here in New England. Bullfrogs in New England start to call late in the summer, and they sound something like this. Which some people think the frog is saying jug of rum. African bullfrogs don't say jug of rum. They're more like...
Our last stop, the poison dart frog, behind glass, of course, like emeralds and rubies in a jeweler's case, when you can find the little things.
They're bunched up over there.
I saw frogs.
What colors?
Green, blue, and orange.
Wow, look at them. They're in a little frog pig pile. Look, oh, there's an orange one.
He just moved.
Their poison is used by rainforest tribes in the Americas on the tips of blow darts, hence the name poison dart frog. But then there's the phantasmal poison frog from Ecuador and Peru. It shows promise in producing a non-addictive, powerful form of morphine. By the way, speaking of drugs, some people lick frogs to try to get high. Lou says, dumb idea. They usually get violently ill instead. And kissing a frog? He says, so far, no evidence of that whole turning into a prince thing. So we asked, what is the one thing people should do that's good and true for frogs?
The best thing, I think, get outdoors, explore nature.
And again, go easy on the pesticides and fertilizers. Lou Stevens, senior curator at Boston's Museum of Science. For more information and pictures from Frogs, A Chorus of Colors, go to hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.